Milo's Money Days are here, and we're making it rain for rewards members. For the first time ever, when you make a purchase of $200 or more through July 12th, you'll get up to $30 back in extra Milo's money. Not a member yet? Join for free today, because members get more at Lowe's. Milo's Money Award varies based on status. Members in gold get 30, silver get 20, and bronze get 10. Milo's Money valid for 30 days. Restrictions and more terms at Lowe's.com/Milo's Money Days.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning in to Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 18, Episode 26. This week, we heard a great interview with Iris Eton about her organization, Protect Ethical Prosecutors. Bob and Iris discussed accountability with prosecutors and how reckless misconduct should be handled. Today, the gang is all here, and the three of us are here to answer your listener questions. But before we get into that, do we have any housekeeping?
I don't think so. Just to give everybody an update, I think I've said this before, but I think it's been pushed, I think, since the last time I mentioned it, because everybody's always asking the West Memphis 3 testing. So the most updated information I have about that is we were told that we will have the results for sure, they say, in July. And I'm also told, and I think I did mention this before, that the prosecutor has now limited the testing down as of for this round just to the laces or the ligatures. So I don't know, I'll give you more on that when I hear more on it. I'm getting everything kind of third hand. Even when I talk to Damien, you know, he's getting it like from the prosecutor to the attorney, to him, to me, you know, so it's all getting like passed around. But yeah, there was, I know there was discussion on, there's a lot of back and forth about preserving evidence and make sure it's still there for future testing. I know that Damien's legal team, their position is like, we have a prosecutor willing to test it. We have advanced technology. Let's test it now. Because saying that we're preserving it for testing it later, history has shown every single prosecutor that's been in that office won't let us test it and turns it into a fight. I don't know how, nobody seems to know how accurate that is, but that's what we're being told is July. So this month, results, and it's going to be just the MBAC on the ligatures is what we're looking at right now. So I'll update you more. I mean, you'll hear, I'm sure the minute the, you know, if there's anything meaningful results to come from it, I'm sure it will be all over the interwebs immediately as soon as that happens. So other than that, I don't think we have any other housekeeping. So we can get right into our discussion. We don't have really any questions. We do have, which we'll get into here in a little bit, like one comment that kind of opens up a really good conversation about what Iris and I talked about. But I just, this was one of those interviews that was just really, it was really fascinating to me. It's not, as I mentioned in the show, I love the way that Iris framed the name of their organization, because it's not what I was expecting, you know, when it's a, you know, Protect Ethical Right. Prosecutors, that really what they're doing is fighting against unethical prosecutors. But I thought it's a great way to frame it. Super interesting, the work they're doing. So, you know, first things first, I want to talk to you guys. What did you guys think about the episode?
You know, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a great episode. The one thing that really stuck with me from this episode that Iris said that I don't want to say that I've ever considered is she basically said that, you know, judges don't have a lot of say in this.
Mm.
No, but I never really considered the idea that prosecutors really put forth the whole case. They put forth what they're being charged with. What mm-hmm. what the charges may be, what the sentence, you know, what they're wanting this to be sentenced, what, I mean, it goes on and on. I never really considered that.
Yeah. So, and it's, my take has always been judges don't have much of an impact on a trial unless they are getting a whole lot wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they're just kind of just ruling based, you know, like, for example, there's been a lot of complaints about the judge in Stephen Avery's trial. or not Stephen Avery, Richard Allen's trial. You know, and it was because there was, you know, all the, you know, she was not allowing the defense to do a whole bunch of things, which, you know, we've had, you know, gosh, I am just drawing our pregame conversation has my mind blown now, so that my brain doesn't work anymore.
It was a good one.
Andrea Burkhart, mm-hmm. you know, where this is what she's a lawyer, this is what she does for a living. And she feels that there were some errors made by the judge in not allowing the defense to do a whole lot. You know, if that's the case, and, you know, that has a severe impact. But for the most part, if the judge is just kind of just ruling, you know, in a basic way, according to law, yeah, the prosecutors control everything. Mm-hmm. They control the biggest frustration to me, and where we see the most misconduct, is that prosecutors control the flow of information. And that's the scary part. You know, when you have, if you have an unethical prosecutor and they're the ones that have all, you know, the police investigate, they turn their file over to the prosecutor. And then the defense is counting on the prosecutor to show them everything in the file. And if the prosecutor is like, this doesn't look good, let's hold that back. You know, there's nothing a judge can do about that unless it's found and discovered, which generally happens maybe 10, 20 years later after the trial. It's, you know, nobody knows there was a Brady violation before the trial happens. So, mm-hmm. yeah, that it is. It's something like you, I've never really put a whole lot of thought into. But as soon as she said it, it's like, yeah, that really, it makes sense. Like, just the prosecutors.
Well, even, I mean, to jump back to last week's episode really quick, I wasn't here, but not to get into it, but even that case, that when you talk about that piece of evidence about, against Ashley Garth, that Garrett Kurtz had wrote a letter mm-hmm. basically confessing that he did it, that she had nothing to do with it, but the letter also said that he had committed a different murder, and they said, well, that didn't happen. We don't know that that happened, so this part can't be entered into evidence, even though it probably would have cleared her.
Right. It certainly had an impact, you would think, what if it had the jury.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's all based on the prosecutor.
Yeah. Well, same thing with, like, you know, Jay Wilds, like waiting. There's like all these like chess moves the prosecutors can make to manipulate the system. You know, like, you know, Jay Wilds, how they waited to charge Jay until after they got what they wanted out of him, because if he's not charged, he's not entitled to a lawyer. You know, so they don't charge him to right. keep him on the, you know, there's like there's little ways that they can play things like that where, like, the judge isn't even involved at that point.
Mm-hmm.
What were your thoughts, Janet?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'll say I think Iris was really, really effective at making her case, because I was, like, very angry pretty much the entire conversation you guys had. Like, every next thing she said, I was like, oh, I am so mad about this. Like, it felt...
Right.
I felt so frustrated and angry in terms of just what she was talking about, what she was saying is happening in, you know, her own kind of jurisdiction and what that is reflective of, and how it was just like all of the piles of misconduct. And, you know, Juan, one of our participants in the Facebook post, we'll get to him, but he probably was feeling the same thing, because it just feels like the weight of every case and every time you've ever heard that happen was just all flooding back at once. It just felt like they were just climbing onto my back. And I was, like, getting so frustrated. And I definitely felt this, you know, very strong desire to want to be a part of the solution, to want to be a part of the action. And also, you know, it felt so absolute. And then I finished listening to us. And this is, again, this is a compliment to Iris. And I'm not saying that she's wrong about anything she said at all. I'm not saying that at all. But as I kind of, like, was cooling off, I was just sort of, like, trying to figure out if I just was trying to figure out, like, God, I guess that is all that you can do. I guess I was just, and then we'll get to Sarah's post, too, because I think Sarah was in a similar headspace of just kind mm-hmm. of, like, God, is opening them up to lawsuits, I guess, like, is that the solution? And I guess the only reason that I hesitated on that is that I just feel like anything that clogs up the courts civilly or criminally even more when people are sitting in jail waiting for their trial because, you know, or are forced to plead out because they just want to get out of jail. It's just in my mind, I was like, oh no, like there's more, we're talking about more legal action that like is more parliamentary procedure kind of stuff when I wish that it was something even cleaner than the threat of that, just because I'm right. so frustrated by the system. It's like, it's just hard sometimes when you get disheartened by the system to be like, well, I can use the system to fight the system. It should be that way. But part of that even was like, I just was struggling. I was like, God, I can't believe that's the best we've got. Like, that felt like kind of disheartening in a sense. And I don't mean anything against Iris. I genuinely am that frustrated by, like, and kind of afraid of how we've gotten ourselves into this mess.
Well, I wonder too, by prosecutors having immunity, obviously you can't go after them for a civil suit. But if someone is found to be wrongfully convicted, they can then sue the state typically and get some sort of reimbursement. It almost seems like the state would want to not have the immunity because then they don't have the burden of that.
Well, I mean, they can still sue the state as well. But yeah, that's what let's do this before we, because I think this is going to be a conversation that's going to eat up most of this episode because I want to talk quite a bit about this. Let's go ahead and read Sarah's post. Because she kind of makes these a lot of good points that I think we can kind of break down after that.
Okay, cool. Sarah says, Iris talks like there is nothing to hold prosecutors in check because they can't be sued. However, they can be disbarred, which is a more serious consequence. Also, the fear of lawsuits hasn't made medicine better. If anything, medicine in the United States has gotten worse because of the fear of lawsuits, and it hasn't stopped unethical doctors. I also don't see how throwing open the doors for lawsuits against prosecutors can or will distinguish between good faith mistakes and intentional misconduct. I agree that prosecutors need to be held accountable for misconduct, but I'm not convinced lawsuits would accomplish that.
Yeah, so there's a lot to unpack there. The first thing that I want to get into is what she said up first, right? She said that, you know, they can't be sued, but they can be disbarred. And Sarah, I put a lot of thought into this after I saw your post, and I really kind of thought this through. And here's the thing. It's kind of what you said, Janet. Like, for a prosecutor to get disbarred relies on the system to police the system. And it doesn't happen. So yes, they can be disbarred, but like, I was only able to find a couple of instances. It's extremely, extremely rare for that to happen, for a prosecutor to get disbarred because of some kind of misconduct. Prosecutorial misconduct is not rare at all. So you have, in many, many, many cases, convictions are overturned in the appellate court, whatever level that's at, will cite prosecutorial misconduct as the reason for overturning the conviction. And nothing happens to those prosecutors. I'm going to say 99.9% of the time, I'm making that stat up, but based on what I've been able to find, like that just doesn't happen. And that's when a conviction gets overturned, when it's a big deal, right? There's hundreds and hundreds of cases like that. But there's also thousands and thousands and thousands of cases where prosecutorial misconduct is cited and the conviction isn't overturned. One example we've talked about on this show, Kerry Max Cook, who, you know, 50 years later was finally, a few years ago, had his conviction overturned. But on multiple occasions when he was trying to get it overturned after he was released, the appellate judges looked at the case and cited extreme, they used like very strong language, extreme, severe, egregious prosecutorial misconduct. But because of where the burdens lie in overturning a conviction, it wasn't enough, right? So like in one case, the judges cited that there was egregious prosecutorial misconduct and there's all this evidence, but there was also the evidence of the one police officer who testified that Kerry confessed to him in the elevator. And that cop was dead, so they couldn't refute that evidence. And so his conviction stood, even though all this prosecutorial misconduct was out there. And so the idea that, to me, it's a fairy tale to say, yeah, but they can be disbarred, because they're not. They're just not disbarred. They're not held accountable by the system. And if the system worked, then this show wouldn't exist, right? So the whole principle behind Truth and Justice is that it's taking outsiders, people working from without, you know, outside of the system, to affect change within it. It takes people from the outside to push back because the system tends to protect itself. So I don't think that the fact that they can, I mean, on paper, yes, it makes sense. Well, yeah, but they can't be sued, but they can be disbarred. I would agree with that wholeheartedly if it ever happened, but it just doesn't ever happen. They're never, I mean, they, you know, in most cases, a prosecutor will prosecute a case, and then 20 years later, it's found that there was, you know, a Brady, and let's say it's even a quick one, you know, right away, people realize there's a Brady violation, they were withholding evidence, And, you know, there's like some of those claims, I think, going on in the Richard Allen cases, you know, that the trial just happened. If a court finds there was prosecutorial misconduct there and they did withhold evidence, nothing happens to them. Like they, you know, the conviction gets overturned or it doesn't or whatever happens. And the prosecutor keeps going about their business. Either they're still the prosecutor or they've moved on to private practice and they just continue to operate. That's how the system works. So I think that there has to be a way from outside the system to try to push back on that. I'm gonna kind of pause there for a minute to get your guys' thoughts on just that element of, you know, the system policing itself before I continue on with the kind of the rest of this. Have you ever found yourself waking up at 3 a.m., mind racing, unable to get back to sleep, or maybe you've noticed that brain fog that makes you lose your train of thought right in the middle of a conversation? For a lot of women, those issues become especially common during perimenopause and menopause. What many people don't realize is that shifting hormones can deplete the magnesium your nervous system depends on. When magnesium levels drop, sleep, focus, mood, and stress tolerance can all take a hit. That's one of the reasons I was interested in learning more about Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers. This isn't just another supplement company jumping on a trend. Their formulas are PhD developed, backed by more than 20 years of research and over 15,000 lab tests. It's the kind of product that health practitioners are quietly recommending to their patients. And what makes Magnesium Breakthrough unique is that it's not just one form of magnesium. It's an all-in-one magnesium complex featuring several different forms working together to support sleep, stress management, energy, and recovery. If you're ready to finally sleep great and feel like yourself again, head to bioptimizers.com/truth and use my exclusive code TRUTH to get 15% off any order. You get great discounts, free gifts, and the peace of mind of never running out. And Bioptimizers is backed with a 365-day, no-questions-asked, money-back guarantee. A full year, zero risk. Because at the end of the day, Bioptimizers' mission is to empower everyone to live a stronger, longer, better life. Again, that's 15% off at bioptimizers.com/truth when you use my code TRUTH. Make this the year you finally get your sleep, your energy, and yourself back.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Well, that's actually really helpful because maybe it would help for me to picture the scenario that you I think, you know, you guys were kind of talking about in a situation like, just walk me through. I mean, I certainly listened to your conversation with Iris. I'm just trying to, like, in the context of this, imagine the scenario in which, okay, so it's okay. Prosecutors no longer have immunity. Someone, Carrie Max Cook, let's say Ed, you know, Ed can now sue the prosecutor who committed prosecutorial misconduct. So he reaches out to an organization like Iris's and says, hey, I can't afford to sue this prosecutor because I don't have the money to sue them, but I have the right to sue them. Will you sue them for, like, will you represent me in this lawsuit, a civil lawsuit, right, against this prosecutor so that I can show a jury of my peers in a civil court that this prosecutor totally ruined my life and sent me to prison completely unfairly and unscrupulously. And then that process, that goes through the process, the trial happens, and then the jury at that point decides, okay, we've decided that you, yes, Ed, you are entitled to, you know, $30 million or whatever. Is that what that would look like?
Well, not as of right now, that's not what Iris's organization does. Primarily because it's not allowed right now, right? So like her organization, their mission isn't to help fund these lawsuits. Their particular organization, their mission is to advocate to change the law,
right?
So that to get rid of immunity. So I just want to be clear about that. So yeah, okay, no, I mean, there's nobody can call their organization to
right. I guess help them. I guess I'm just saying like what I guess I was hoping that that would be the next step, because otherwise I don't know. Like you just I just want to make sure that there are people who are standing by, who are
I think
to
in
make
most
that
cases,
happen.
I think I mean as far as the mechanics of how to get an attorney to represent you in a lawsuit, I would think it'd probably be like most civil suits like that. There's a really good litmus test for civil suits in the fact that most civil suit attorneys, or a lot of them, I shouldn't say most because I don't know, but I know a lot of them because I've dealt with some things before in the past. They operate on, we'll represent you and our fee is we're taking 30% of whatever you get, you know, so right. You don't have to come, because a lot of people who don't have the money to pay for a lawyer are able to get one for a lawsuit. And the litmus test, whether it's a legitimate case, is an attorney who looks at it and says, you're not going to win this, you don't have a case, isn't going to take it because they're not going to get paid.
Right.
Right. So it's like, if you get an attorney that's like, oh, yes, I'll take your case, it's a pretty good indication that they feel you have a strong case. I'm dealing with some of that right now with just some issues I have with the township up where my property is up, mm-hmm. up north. And that's part of the conversation, is gathering evidence and finding out. So I don't think that you're not going to have a whole lot of money in order to get an attorney to sue somebody. If you have a legitimate case, there will be an attorney, you know, right. for a percentage of that will take it.
And that assumes a sort of sea change that would have already happened, because there had to be enough groundswell support for the idea that it should be okay to prosecute unethical prosecutors, to sue them, is that like you've already, the buy-in is already there, so that it would, you would imagine that a lawyer wouldn't look at this and say, well, prosecutors used to never even be held accountable at all. Like, this is going to be a really hard, they're going to have a great defense as to why the prosecution works like this and da-da-da, and like, I don't see you winning this. So it assumes that part of this whole movement is that everyone, probably except the prosecutors, everyone outside of the system is buying in enough that that a judge can't throw out the suit just like they could in a criminal court, you know, and they can't throw it like, and that a lawyer wouldn't say, well, you're going up against a prosecutor, you're never going to win this. I can't take your case unless you pay me.
No, yeah, I think we're assuming we're in a, if we're at that place, and I still want to circle back to the disbarment part of it. But that you're in this place where, like, it's accepted now, law of the land is there is not absolute immunity. If you have, like, agree, and keep in mind, I personally don't think there should be, like, open season on prosecutors. Because Sarah's right. Like when it comes to, like a lot of the reason that medical care in the United States costs as much as it does is because there's so much lawsuits. You know, every time something bad happens, doctors get sued constantly. But, you know, I think there should be something along, you know, there should be some kind of standard where it's like, if there's egregious prosecutorial misconduct, you know, if a lawyer or if a prosecutor gets a piece of exculpatory evidence from the police and they withhold it from the defense, and then that results in this person going to prison, and it's discovered later that they had it the whole time and they withheld it, I think that prosecutor should be held personally accountable for what they did, because that's the issue. Like Zach said, the state can get sued, but the person who's doing it has no personal account. They have no risk personally. There's no concern of like, if I do this and I get caught, I'm going to go to jail. Or yeah, Simone in the chat mentioned, and she's right, there was a prosecutor in Texas, I think it was like 2 or 3 years ago, that actually did get convicted. I think it's like the first time in the country it's ever happened. And it cost somebody like years of their lives for this egregious misconduct. And they were sentenced to 2 weeks and got off in a week on good behavior. Like that was the only time they've ever even been close to being held accountable for it.
Well, and I feel like that's where I feel like it's less financial. Maybe I'm reading too much into this. I don't know. I know that Iris did talk about the financial aspect of being like civil suits, but I also think just the idea of the accountability, it almost feels like they're building, for lack of a better term, an accountability database, right?
Yeah.
They've literally talked about, you know, putting together lists of prosecutors that have all these misconduct against them and trying to educate more in the system, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's the way that I feel like you kind of hold accountability, is you continue to compile these lists and you put it out there so that other jurisdictions can see this, right? Because it's it's not just disbarment, but I mean, disbarment is the, would be the ultimate, you know, then they can no longer work. But if it's like, you know, she talked about in the episode, basically these guys getting a slap on the hand and getting to go back to work. But if you can pile these lists, then they, then it starts to add up. It's not just.
Yeah. Well, and the financial aspect of it too, like I look at it a little bit differently. I'm not, and maybe I should, but I'm not looking at it as if a prosecutor does this to a person, that person deserves compensation. I'm looking at it more from the other side of it, which is what's going to affect a change in behavior is not how much money this person's getting, but how much money this person has to pay, right? And how much insurance they have to cover.
Sure. For sure. You know, I'm not saying,
just some kind
I'm
of liability.
I'm not saying that either.
Just to put a quick button, can we agree that the idea of disbarment, or do we agree, I should ask, that the idea of, well, they could be disbarred is just really, it's kind of meaningless because they just never are?
Yeah.
Oh, for sure. And like, yeah, no, and I'm not saying that, Zach, I'm really glad that you brought that up because I had forgotten about that piece of it. That was just that the idea is that, you know, that there's shame involved.
Yeah,
that there's
yeah.
actual exposure and shame, and that the shame and the disincentivizing to do that because it's actually going to get called out and made a bigger deal of than it ever has been, that should be the goal. I guess that's the only thing I was trying to puzzle myself, and I am not an expert in this in any way, shape, or form. I was just trying to think if there was any other way also even. I'm not even saying it can't be that there's different legislation that now all it does is undo the immunity that prosecutors have enjoyed for so long. I guess I was just trying to think, like, God, you know, like, why, you know, where does that transparency, where can that transparency happen? And, you know, it's like, where can there be an outside? I mean, everything gets corrupted. I guess when I'm getting really negative, I just feel like everything gets corrupted and everything is like a good old boys network. And I know it's not like that every time. But that was the kind of taste
in
my
is
mouth.
Like that
I mean,
in this
that was
case.
The taste in my mouth after that conversation. So I was like, God, it just, you know, how like, is there why can't the bar be more like, we investigate these cases? We independently, this is a group that has been put together. It's got X people, these kinds of lawyers, these kinds of people. This is the track record you have to have. And we do case review and like in a conviction integrity unit. But like external to that local, you know, jurisdiction of that particular DA's office or whatever, that like that exists and is robust and is like hardcore. It's like Iris is saying, like, we need to protect the lawyers that are doing good work because they're out there and we're getting the whole like one bad apple ruins the bunch. It is our we let people have the bar. Like, I mean, we let people have.
Right.
Have their license. So we need to be accountable for who we give it to and who we take it away from. And if somebody is executing power that is an absolute misuse of that, in the same way you see with, you know, bad cops and that, like, what makes me so crazy is just like the amount of people who don't want the government in their business at all, but for some reason are like so sure that like the criminal justice system is working great. It blows my mind. Whenever I think about someone who's like,
agreed.
If we have to take up arms and fight the government, God damn it, we will. And I'm like, what about?
Yeah.
What about if they come and get you? Why do you think that's like, why are you not worried about that? But you're worried about, you know, it's, and I know that's a political thing and I don't want to get people too all hot up about it. But I just, the idea that we don't care enough to say, hey, guess what? You have a lot of power in this situation. Here's how this checks and balances needs to work. And we as citizens are a part of that. And by the way, the place that tells you you have a license to practice is going to also be accountable if they gave a license to somebody who is using it in bad form, just like a bad doctor who's like, well, this person's killing people. Like, don't let them practice medicine anymore.
So I think a perfect solution would be somehow, and I just don't know how you do it, is somehow to make the bar hold prosecutors accountable. Like, to me, there should be no excuse. You like you said, they're wielding this massive amount of power and you're taking people's lives away. And it's like, if they bring before the bar, like, hey, they just took 20 years of this guy's life away because they were intentionally hiding evidence from them. Like, that shouldn't be a slap on the wrist. That should be beyond even, to me, like, In my perfect world, that person goes to prison. That should be criminal. They certainly at least should get disbarred. The lawsuit is the only reason the lawsuit, and I agree with Iris on this. I think the reason taking away the immunity as far as lawsuits is concerned is meaningful is because that's the only way where we don't have to rely on the system to check itself. Because whoever we put into that position, whether we elect them in there, we put them in there, whatever we do, you have to rely on them to do their jobs properly. And they're just not. They never have. They have never, ever, ever cared. You know, the system has always cared more about finality of justice than they have about actual justice. You know, it's like, well, you know, they got a guilty verdict. We need to protect that. And we need to protect the system. And we need to protect the system at all costs. It's like, no, you need to protect the people. That's the point of the system, is to protect the people.
I think the only part that I have a really hard time with is the vast span of the accountability, because you have these prosecutors that you can say are making a good faith mistake. She used that term, a good faith mistake. And you have prosecutors that are absolutely reckless. You know, how do you determine what's what? How do you determine any accountability?
You have to examine it the same way police examine evidence against a person that they've arrested.
Well, let me put it. I want to touch on the comparison to the medical thing, and it's going to lead into what you're talking about there and what Sarah mentioned there. So, like, I don't see the parallel between the medical field and the prosecutors. There's a bit of a parallel there, but I don't think not to me, in my opinion, not as much as we want to put on it. And the difference is doctors who are getting sued for malpractice. Generally, not always. There's certainly like, but when it's not this, there's like a movie made about it. Generally, they're trying to help someone, and they're all good faith mistakes. Not always. Obviously, there's people because if we get down to, you know, they're prescribing opioids when they shouldn't, you know, stuff like that is a little different. But like the surgeon who operates on somebody and they die and they get sued, right? And they do. They get sued. By the way, also defense attorneys get sued when they screw up. Everybody gets sued when they screw up, except for prosecutors. But those doctors, I think there's a distinct difference between a doctor who's doing their best. There's no motivation whatsoever to not do their best to save the life of a patient or to help a patient. And sometimes they make mistakes and that results in somebody's death or dismemberment or whatever the case may be. They amputated the wrong arm. It's hard to argue that a large majority of those, I'm trying real hard not speaking absolutes because I know there, because somebody would be like, yeah, but there was this time. I know it happens, right? So there are others, but in general, most medical malpractice suits are good faith mistakes. Like the intention was to help and they screwed something up. And that led to a bad thing that led them to get sued. With prosecutors, there's no excuse. You have one job and one job only. And it's to determine whether this person goes to prison for the rest of their life or they don't. And you make calculated decisions that aren't heat of the moment decisions like a doctor has to make, but are like long. I mean, how long does it take between arrest and trial? Usually average 18 months to plan and plan and plan how you're going to strategize this trial. And as part of that strategy over months and months and months, you decide to hide things to better your chances of sending this person to prison for the rest of their life. I just don't think there's that much of a parallel there. You guys feel free to disagree with me, but that to me, when I'm looking at it, it's like, it's not the same. Let me go on and then I'll let you guys go. I want to quick, before I lose my train of thought, tie this into the idea of good faith mistake. So one of the things that Sarah said is how will lawsuits distinguish between good faith mistakes and intentional misconduct? Here's my thought on this. Maybe an unpopular opinion. It doesn't matter. When I was a fireman, if somebody called me because their house was on fire and I showed up and did my very best to save their house, if I made a good faith mistake and it caused their house to burn down or somebody to get hurt or killed, or I, for some reason, intentionally did something that caused the house to burn down and caused somebody to get hurt or killed, it doesn't fucking matter. I'm going to get sued either way, right? If I do a thing that causes harm, in every other place, aside from prosecutors, whether it was a good faith mistake or whether it was intentional, doesn't matter. It may make a difference, like in the amount you get. You know, if it's like it was a genuine mistake. They did their best. I can justify the reasons I did this. It didn't work out. Maybe, a jury of my peers might let me off the hook. In most cases, you're not, but maybe the amount of money you have to pay for it is going to be a little less. But I'm not less liable because of ignorance. I'm not less liable because the bad thing I did was an accident. Think a car accident. You know, if you intentionally ram somebody and hurt them, or you just get in an accident, like, you're still liable for the thing that you did in any case. So I don't think it really matters. So if there's a Brady violation, for example, in what we're talking here, prosecutors, cops talk to a witness who said, I saw the guy that did it and it wasn't Zach. And I'm going to go to put Zach on trial, and I never give the defense that witness statement. Okay, now if I get sued later for that, it's found out, oh, wait a minute, this whole time there was this witness statement, and the prosecutor, and maybe honestly so, is like, oh my God, that piece of, yeah, that's, it fell out of my drawer. You know, it fell out of the file. It was, I did not mean to withhold that. It was an accident. Like, should that mean, oh, well, then you're fine.
Right.
You're not. You still cost him 20 years of his life, whether it was a mistake or, now, how, you know, how punitive it's going to be and how much it's going to affect you afterward, perhaps that plays into it. If they can make a real argument and really show this was an accident, I didn't mean to do this unethical thing,
mm-hmm.
it was a mistake. But the idea to me that, well, I'm not liable now because it was an oopsie and it's not something I did on purpose, that doesn't matter in any other place or profession unless we're talking about prosecutors.
Hmm.
The way I look at this is, you are talking about civil suit financially, right? Like, so you're talking about, if you make an oopsie, you're getting sued. If you do this maliciously, you're getting sued.
Right.
I'm looking at, like, the bigger picture of, like, what happens to you? Are you prosecuted? Or are you not prosecuted? If you are a firefighter and you make an oopsie and a house burns down, it's awful. Someone's going to come through. You're probably going to be on probation, whatever. But if they can tell that you maliciously did this, you're going to be fired. You're going to be blacklisted, most likely.
Right.
That's where I'm saying, how do you differentiate?
Well, that kind of goes back to the earlier part of the conversation, that in that case, yeah, the fire chief would be like, you're fired. The fire board, the safety board, whoever, the city council is going to probably fire you for doing this thing. Right.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, that's the bar. But we've already determined the bar is not going to do shit.
Right.
Unless we somehow figure out how to fix that problem, which is a different. I agree with Janet. That's what needs to be fixed, but I don't know how to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, like, it's kind of what I was saying earlier, like, it's not about how much money do I deserve because you did this based on what you did or not.
Right.
The whole idea is, and I think what Iris is getting at, is when I have that piece of paper and I'm deciding whether to give it to the defense or not, if I know, if I don't, and I get caught, nothing's going to happen to me, how much more likely am I to hide it than if I don't give them this and I get caught, I'm going to have consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It may not be that I'm going to be disbarred, but I'm going to get sued. It's going to cause, it's going to, and these lawsuits are going to start to stack up if you're doing it regularly. So the idea is the fear, it's the same reason we send people to prison, right?
Mm-hmm.
The fear of the consequence,
deterrent.
We hope will stop the behavior in most people.
Right.
Right. And so that's what we're hoping, because these are not things that are happening in the heat of battle. These are planned strategic decisions that prosecutors are making. And so in that planning, and most prosecutors, you want to assume, are pretty intelligent folks,
mm-hmm.
that they're probably doing this, like, cost-benefit analysis with every decision they're making, because that's just how smart people think. And if the cost-benefit is, well, the benefit is I'm going to win the trial and the cost is nothing, no matter what, what's to stop you other than just being an ethical person, which is who we're trying to protect, the ethical prosecutors.
Correct.
Right? But if it's, but the cost, the benefit is I win. But the cost is, if I get caught, I'm gonna get sued, and I'm gonna get sued repeatedly. And if that lawsuit is not just for the individual prosecutor, but also the prosecutor's office, at what point does that happen? The consequence happen that you're talking about, where the head DA, whoever, mm-hmm. or the taxpayers fire that person, elect somebody else, kick them out of office because they're like, this one prosecutor, this one ADA. Has been sued 7 times. It's cost their city $20 million because they keep doing this shit. They're out of here. But right now, they don't, it's like, well, look at their win record. Let's just keep them going.
Yeah.
Now, that's my soapbox thoughts. Hey, everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pre-game podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk. Still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Well, I'm definitely hearing you out, and I'm not meaning to like argue with you about it because I just
please do it. I'm fine.
I continue to think about the more you, as it spirals in my head, you know, doctors have malpractice insurance,
and lawyers would do too, and so, prosecutors should probably would also.
So then you're taking the financial liability out of it again because they're carrying this insurance that it's going to pay for the lawsuit.
We were talking about liability insurance earlier in the pregame.
Yeah.
So that multiple millions of dollars of coverage that you have to have as a tattoo artist.
Yeah.
What do you think happens to your premium if someone sues you for $3 million?
It's going up for sure.
Not a little.
Yeah. Well, probably a lot. As I say that out loud, it's probably not only is it not going up, you're probably not getting covered again.
Yeah. It'll go up and then they'll cancel you.
Yeah.
Right. So if somebody sues you for $20 million, it's not like you probably are going to personally have to pay $20 million. Mm-hmm.
Right.
But you're going to have to pay something.
Also, I don't have $20 million with insurance for anybody listening. Don't.
If anybody
don't,
that was the number, looking for a quick number out there. Go get tattooed by Zach and tell him that you got the flu.
Threw a number out there that I'm not happy with.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like it may not be as direct as that, but there's an impact because what happens to you in your shop? You get sued, mm-hmm. The insurance pays it out, and then the insurance says, you're because of your practices. Because that's what happened. That's what would happen to me as a PI or as a broadcaster. That's what would happen to you as a tattooer. Any business out there is the insurance company is looking at like how much risk are you for me to take on?
Mm-hmm.
And if you start proving if you do something and it costs them millions of dollars, they're going to look and say, well, what practices are they doing? And if they look and it's like, well, this person has been sued and has cost us a lot of money on multiple occasions. We're canceling it. We're not covered. You're too big of a risk because of the way you operate. And that ends up, you end up getting like literally blacklisted for insurance companies. You ever notice when you apply for insurance, one of the questions they ask is, have you ever had a policy canceled?
Mm-hmm.
That's why.
Okay.
Yeah. And they cancel you. So now what happens if you get sued, they pay, and then the insurance company cancels you and you can't get, like nobody will cover you. You can't get insurance for your business. What happens to your business?
well, the business collapses, but it doesn't, right. I mean, that does directly affect me. My business has collapsed, but I could go on to somewhere else. Just like like a prosecuting attorney could, I mean, in this instance, their firm collapses, but now they go work for somebody.
Well, but that's not really how it will work with this, because in this case, the insurance company would be covering the individual. Like if we're talking about prosecutors are allowed to be sued as individuals, mm-hmm. then they're after to cover individual insurance that covers them as an, so it'd be like, it's not just Conception Gallery Tattoo Shop mm-hmm. that's covered by this policy. Zach Weaver, as an individual tattoo artist, say there was a rule that says you have to be covered.
Yeah.
With so much like I said, I just got my Indiana filing for my Indiana PI license. The state of Indiana requires Indiana PIs to carry a certain amount and type of liability insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And if the insurance companies were like, we're not going to cover you, then guess what? I don't get to work anymore. You know?
Fair enough.
Janet, we've been talking for a long time.
No. I mean, I think that's all really compelling. And that makes a ton of sense. The two things I was going to say is, so the SCOTUS case that Iris was talking about, I see your note to self here in the outline that Imbler versus Pactman in 1976, that's the decision that the Supreme Court said, okay, this is too dangerous for prosecutors. This is gumming up the works, or like that you're just open to too much vulnerability in a job in which we need to make sure you're more protected so that you can do your job. Like that's sort of what they said. And
well, it was just like any case, it was a loss. It was a lawsuit that was appealed all the way up to the Supreme Court, and it involved a 1983 lawsuit, which is the type of lawsuit you do if you're falsely imprisoned. You know that you can. That's where you like sue the state, right?
Mm-hmm. Wait,
and
that's a 1983
lawsuit.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's not a year. That's just the type of lawsuit.
Oh, I see. But, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So this a 1983 suit against, I believe the way I've read the decision. It's a long decision, but I'm trying to work from memory right now. But it was, you know, essentially they were suing the state and also wanted to include the individual prosecutor in the lawsuit. And the Supreme Court's decision basically said, no, you can't sue him personally, because that's going to open the door to where prosecutors are basically afraid to do their job because they're getting sued for prosecuting. They have to be able to go through their own procedures and do it. So it was just like any Supreme Court case. The ruling was in that case, they decided and they put into their decision that it's going to, as you put it, kind of like gum up the works if we are allowing these individual prosecutors to get sued on top of just the state being sued. But that, because it was the Supreme Court, set a precedent. So now that's case law,
right?
That, you know, when something like that happens in the Supreme Court, that means, well, now the law of the land is you can't sue a prosecutor.
And when was Brady decided?
Brady v. Maryland was... I'm stalling while Zach looks it up.
Perfect.
63.
Okay. So this decision is made in 1976. Brady is a really good, potentially a good representation of the sort of like wake up moment of like, oh shit, like this is a thing that happens. We now have something we can point to and say, just like what you were saying about case law with this decision, hey, you can't do this because we can cite this case. So you have, between 63 and 76, you have 13 years. I guess my curiosity is, like, did the Supreme Court justices say? And as you can see, ever since Brady versus Maryland, the decision came down 13 years ago, we've seen nothing but prosecutors getting sued. Look, right and left, every time there's a Brady violation, it looks like a prosecutor's getting sued. Like, this is outrageous. It's out of control. We got to make this decision to stop all of this. Or was it like, that never happened until this one case? And they were like, whoa, hold on, this is a problem.
I don't think that it was one or the other, but I think prior to that, like, people were suing prosecutors.
Yeah, okay.
Prior to this. And in this instance, the prosecutor, I believe, lost a lawsuit and appealed the lawsuit all the way. And kept saying, like, they can't sue me. I was just trying to do my job. They can't sue me. They can sue the state if they want, but they can't sue me. I was just trying to do my job. And, like, it went all the way up. And so for the first time in 1976, it lands on the Supreme Court's desk or bench, and they looked at it and said, no, we think you're right. They shouldn't be able to sue you because you were just trying to do your job. And like you said, I know I'm preaching to the choir for 99% of my audience, but for those that don't quite understand how that works, you know, it's like, you know, when we talk about a Brady violation, it was the same thing. It was somebody found out guy, last name Brady, in the state of Maryland, finds out that, hey, the prosecutor was withholding exculpatory evidence, and they tried to get their conviction overturned because of that. But there was no law that anything that very specifically said that, right? So the Supreme Court's job is to interpret the Constitution. So they were saying, well, where the Constitution says this, that should apply to them not turning over this evidence. It got all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, you know, you're right. We are going to overturn your conviction because they didn't turn over exculpatory evidence. So boom, now that's the law of the land.
Right.
You have to turn over exculpatory evidence. Which, and so we're
even that is compromised because you don't know what you don't know. I mean, from a defense right. side of things.
But what it did, was it took a very broad thing, you know, as far as like your constitutional due process rights, where it was like prior to that, and that's how most Supreme Court cases work, is like prior to that, it's like, well, it's assumed in this jurisdiction that includes your due process includes turning over exculpatory evidence. And then in this jurisdiction, they're like, oh, well, that doesn't really fit the. And so it goes all the way up to SCOTUS. And then they're like, no, that's part of it. Right. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the Strickland case for ineffective assistance of counsel. Like all of these standards that we're familiar with all happened in that way where somebody was like, I got convicted because my lawyer sucked. And they're like, you know, that this gets argued and appealed all the way up until the Supreme Court said, you know what? That was a violation of your constitutional rights by your lawyer sucking, because it says that everybody's entitled to good counsel, and you didn't get good counsel. So we're saying if your lawyer's bad, then yes, your conviction should be overturned. Boom. There's the Strickland. So now there's ineffective assistance of counsel is a thing. Same thing happened here. So my assumption is, and it is just an assumption, that prior to this 1976 decision, that some prosecutors were probably in some jurisdictions, prosecutors were getting sued and they were losing. Some they were getting sued, they were winning. Someone appealed it all the way up to, you know, Pacman was the prosecutor. They assumed they appealed it all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, no, you can't sue them.
Right. Yeah.
So that became the law.
It's interesting. I mean, the whole conversation, and I think we've already gone maybe a lot longer than you expected that we would, but the whole, I don't want to back off from strong, definitive opinion and wanting to take a positive course of action and feel like it's crystal clear. It feels so good to do that. And as challenging as it is, it feels good to feel like you have morality or, you know, ethics on your side, and you're going to push forward and do this. So I'm sorry to like complicate this or to say like this feels complicated, but like what it made me think of, and this is an entirely other conversation, is just like, for example, mandatory reporters for child abuse, right? Like mm-hmm. you are required, on one hand, you're required to report suspicion of child abuse if you're a type of mandatory report, like if you're a teacher or if you're a doctor and a child is brought in and you have like reasonable assumption, quote unquote, whatever, you know, that is determined to meet by the law of this happening, then you report it. And when you, if you do that and then the family turns around and sues you, then you're now being disincentivized from protecting a child because it comes back on right. you. So I understand the concept of like, you should be able to do your job without constantly fearing that someone's going to seek retribution for an act yeah. that is intended to protect the people who need to be protected. In the case of prosecutors, protecting the prosecutors so that they can extend it out, right? So that they can protect the victims and they can prosecute yeah. against the criminals. So I get it. Like, I get that. And so I'm not saying that there isn't a solution. I'm just saying, like with everything, you know, I'm just like processing through like what can this mean? How could this have an effect? What are the laws of unintended consequences? Like what am I missing? And I guess I think you taught me how to look at things like that, Bob. Like what am I missing here? Before I just say, yes, this is the answer, I just want to make sure I understand what we're saying, how it can be used against things I believe in and for things I believe in, and is it exactly the right answer? And I am not the person, I am not the intellectual to make that choice by myself or even in a group. And people, you know, that are make this their life and career or passion are going to be better informed than I. But I do feel like part of that is the problem, is that we as citizens want to be able to have the responsibility and therefore the onus to know what we're talking about to be part of the accountability process. So I just feel like I want to know more. I want to feel like with so many things we talk about, I want to feel like I'm part of a solution, but I want to feel like I'm a part of a solution that I intelligently walked into knowing, hey, you know what? There's going to be some downsides to this. And this is what they're probably going to be, or like there may be something we haven't thought of. I've just been taught to be a critical thinker. And again, I blame you in part for that. So I'm just thinking like that's all.
Yeah, no. And I agree with you. And that as this situation is no different than other situations that I've talked about many times where like, I don't know exactly what the solution is. I certainly see in this. So I'm with you. I don't want to make it sound like I'm like, yeah, this will absolutely fix it, because that's not my position on this. I think there's a good step, but I think it needs tweaks because Sarah's point is not incorrect, that the lawsuits in the medical profession have caused a lot of harm in the medical profession. It's caused it to be more expensive. There are so many frivolous lawsuits. You know, there's been a lot of talk over the years of tort reform, which is, you know, limiting what you can sue for and what you can't sue for. But that's a kind of a state issue. Like Michigan, where we live, is actually pretty good about the tort laws. It's like there has to be like real damage. You know, you can't just, you know, the whole, well, you know, pain and suffering, emotional trauma. Every time some little thing happens, it just, they're usually thrown out. But that's a state thing. So, yeah, I want to make sure I'm clear. I 100% agree with Sarah's point that like it did. It really bogged down and raised costs in the medical profession. And I could see that happening here. If I'm going to put on my king of the world hat and say, OK, well, I only say this because I don't know how to do it. If I've decided there's just no way to fix the bar, like there's no way to get the bar to like just hold people accountable. Because that's the best solution. The best solution is somebody gets cited for prosecutorial misconduct. They're just barred and prosecuted themselves. Like it should be a crime, in my opinion. I think this is kind of more of a path of least resistance, is by just removing the civil immunity from them. I think that a good way to, you know, if I could just wave a wand and say, well, okay, how could it work the best? I think the solution would be you can sue a prosecutor if an appeals court cites and agrees that there was in fact prosecutorial misconduct, right? Every time somebody gets convicted,
yeah,
that you're just like, oh, I got convicted because the prosecutor was crooked and I'm suing him.
Yeah.
Like that would just
That's
be
kind
a
of what
nightmare.
I'm saying. Yeah. Like having a body that you ideally trust and it's not an appeals court made up of former prosecutors. Who all know each other.
Well, the thing is,
it's not like that everywhere. I know that they're a good prosecutor. Look at the prosecutor in Stephanie's in the case of Everything They Missed that actually made the speech. I believe my job is to find the truth, to find the truth. That's not even I believe my job is to prosecute people. It's even simpler than that. My job is to find the truth. And, you know, like I know that exists. I know those people are out
there. And my feeling on it is the system is maybe not great, but much better about acknowledging and citing that there was, in fact, prosecutorial misconduct. Like I said, most overturned convictions are because of a very small handful of overturned convictions are because of actual innocence, where it's like it's proven, oh, you got the wrong guy, it was this guy. Most of them are overturned because of prosecutorial misconduct of some kind, a due process, a constitutional violation that's cited as prosecutorial misconduct. But then, like I said earlier, there are a ton of cases where a court will agree that there was prosecutorial misconduct, but then determine that's still not enough to overturn the conviction. So I think like that could be at least a stepping stone, a bar. Like if it is cited that there was in fact prosecutorial misconduct, it was proven in a court of law that there was prosecutorial misconduct, then that opens the door for lawsuits. And that would be my hope, because, you know, there's the insurance companies, as much as, and that's a whole, you know, nobody likes an insurance company for all kinds of reasons. That's a whole different discussion. But where they could be useful here is one of the reasons they don't like insurance companies is because, you know, their whole, for an insurance company to succeed, they take your money and they never pay anything. So that's what they're always trying to do. And you know, like in my case, like for me to get my insurance, I have to give them a set of like standard operating procedures. There are some professions where they will come in and inspect your business, your, you know, before they're willing to cover you. that they will, you know, they're like, we want to know how you operate because we want to know how much of a liability you are. And so like that could, so it's like if you did two things, if you remove the absolute immunity and maybe limit it to if prosecutorial misconduct is cited and agreed to by a panel of judges, then that opens you up to a lawsuit. And then you add to that a requirement where in order to operate as a prosecutor, you are required to maintain X amount of dollars worth of liability coverage. And then the insurance. So now, like, if you don't have insurance, you can't work. And then the insurance companies, I guarantee you, will be like, well, we want to know how you operate. We want to look at your track record. We want to know how you operated. So if you come in and it's like this new law gets passed and you're whatever, fill in the blank, you know, crooked prosecutor. And they're like, okay, well, let me look through your previous cases. And it's like, well, you've been cited by 10 different judges for prosecutorial misconduct on 10 different cases.
Yeah.
Like, we're either not covering you.
Yeah.
Or we'll cover you at an extremely high rate.
Which in and of itself is another disincentive to do bad deeds.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, so the whole idea is I don't think there's a magic wand. I don't think anything is going to fix everything completely. You know, because that's like saying, you know, well, I know how to stop murders. Let's make murders illegal and send people to prison for life for them.
Right.
Well, you know, people still murder people.
Yeah.
So, and that'll still be the case here. But if we can cut down on it, if so much of our job was not focused around trying to fight against unethical prosecutors, just think of like how much time is spent in the post-conviction space with the, you know, Innocence Projects, all attorneys that work in that space, how much of their time is spent doing the Susan Simpson work where it's like going through these case files in constant detail to try to find the thing because you know the prosecutor hid something. You know, look at, you know, we're not going to have time to get to it, but Juan, just, you know, I like the idea of your post. We'll talk about it. I think it's a good question for us to talk about in another
one. I was just thinking that. I was like, ooh, we got to wrap up, but I did shout out Juan and we should acknowledge what he posted at least.
Yeah. But like, for example, like in Jody's case, you know, in that case, the prosecutor and the lead detective, like, it's very obvious, like they appear to have made many intentional steps to convict somebody that they knew didn't do it. And because of that, instead of us doing what we should be doing in post-conviction work, which is like, hey, let's find out, let's investigate who did this. Instead of doing that, we're spending all of our time trying to prove how they intentionally screwed them over because of all the misconduct. So if we can find a way to do something that's going to at least curtail that, I'm all for it. And I'll say this about what Iris is doing. What else is anybody else doing?
Oh, 100%. Again, 100%. I am,
you know what I mean?
Certainly
agreed.
Not
agreed.
In any way poo-pooing what Iris is. Yeah, the conversation with Iris. It's so important even just to be talking and thinking about this stuff too.
I did find two case laws where there is not absolute immunity. There's Burns versus Reed from 1991 and Kalina versus Fletcher from 1997. And there is a definition of absolute immunity and one called qualified immunity. And prosecutors can be sued civilly for swearing to facts or attesting to affidavits incorrectly. So there's two different types. That the absolute that we've been talking about is them hiding evidence, them evaluating evidence, mm-hmm. and presenting charges that aren't accurate. But if they go into court and falsely testify, they can be.
Right, which is a whole interesting thing because generally the prosecutors don't testify. There's two
Supreme Court case laws based around this.
Yeah, that'd be an interesting conversation for a follow-up, but we are now, we're an hour in with one question. Good job, Sarah. Your question was an hour, a full hour.
Yeah.
Longest follow-up we've had in a long
time.
Right. So we'll go ahead and we're going to wrap this thing up. I will tell you, we have guests I'm super excited about this week. 3 years ago, I had Alex Campbell on, who is a teacher in Tennessee, who was teaching a sociology class, who had his students to try to find a way to think outside the box and how he taught and to get the kids engaged, had them start investigating a series of potential serial murders, were very successful in doing so. iHeart made a podcast called Murder 101 about his class. And I had him on a few years ago to talk about that. And that episode is going to be airing this Thursday as our Throwback Thursday episode, because on Sunday, I've invited Alex back and he's continued to do the same work with his class. They've now been doing it for 8 years. He had his students while continuing to investigate real life cases, write a book. They wrote and published a book. And on Monday, so the day after you hear from him, on Amazon Prime, there is a new three-part docuseries about his class and the work they've done titled Murder 101 is going to be coming out on Monday. So I, you know, Alex is on the advisory. He was an inspiration for my investigative journalism class. He's on my advisory board at my school. He's an awesome guy. So when I saw he had all this stuff going on with his class, I invited him back. So we're going to hear from him and about everything they've done in his class for the last 3 years on Sunday. So make sure you tune into that. And we will talk all about that next week on your Friday follow-up. We'll talk to you guys then.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production. Co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk, still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.